headlines. A Palestinian man dies in an Israeli prison several days after his arrest. Media reports say he succumbed to torture inside the prison. French President Emmanuel Macron calls a national security meeting to discuss the Israeli-made Pegasus spyware after reports about its use in France. And also on our headlines, China rejects the World Health Organization plan for a second phase of an investigation into the origins of COVID-19. Hello and welcome everybody. A Palestinian prisoner has died in an Israeli jail, with media reports suggesting the man succumbed to torture inside the prison. Abdi Yusuf al-Khatib al-Tamimi was found dead in a cell in a prison in the city of Al-Quds. Palestinian media say Israeli prison staff severely beat him and used electric shock against him. But Israeli authorities say al-Tamimi died of heart attack, a claim the victim's family has rejected, saying he has had no pre-existing medical conditions. Al-Tamimi was arrested for driving offenses and leaves behind a wife and four children. He is the latest victim among thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli prisons, many of them without charge. Palestinian prisoners are kept under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Many of them are subjected to systemic torture, harassment, and repression. Joining us now from Ramallah is a professor of political science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr. Professor Nimr, welcome to the program. First of all, give us your thoughts on the death of Abdi Yusuf al-Tamimi at the hands of the Israeli regime in their prisons.
The Israeli conduct generally against the Palestinian prisoners, in general, it's always to dehumanize the Palestinians. They never consider the Palestinian life matters at all. And that's why the ill treatment regarding the Palestinian prisoners, not only in Al-Maskoubiyeh, where Abdu al-Tamimi was killed this morning, but also on all other prisoners. We are talking about more than 270 Palestinian prisoners died inside the Israeli prisons due to the ill treatment and the lack of treatment for the sick people in prison. Now, concerning the Tamimi issue, he was arrested for only a driving ticket, and he was kept in the Maskoubiyeh detention center. But apparently the brutality of the Israeli police, as the family had said, and based on witnesses who were there, they witnessed that he was beaten and he was assaulted against the law, and that what led to his death. Now the family is asking for an autopsy, and at the same time that they have a doctor, a special doctor from their side, to witness to the autopsy in order to understand what really happened. But apparently the brutality of the Israeli police and the brutality of the Israeli government generally against the Palestinian prisoners is always on the scope of the Palestinians, and we always have these cases. Every year almost we have more than one or two Palestinian prisoners died in Israeli prisons, either due to the harsh interrogation, which in most cases they are using torture. And in Israel, it is the only country, I believe, that by law in 1999, the High Court allowed the Israeli interrogators to use, as they put it, a mild pressure on the Palestinian prisoners. Mild pressure could be interpreted in any way they feel, but that is allowing them to do torture against the Palestinian prisoners, and due to that, many Palestinians died during the interrogation in the Israeli prisons and in the Israeli detention centers, let alone the bad treatment for the Palestinian sick prisoners. We are talking about more than 700 Palestinian prisoners now in the Israeli prison, and they are all suffering of different illnesses, and some of them with cancer, some of them with other kind of illnesses, but the Israeli authorities do not treat them at all, and if they do, it will be the minimal in these cases, which led to several death in the Israeli prison because of this lack of treatment. All in all, we can say that Israel do act against the Palestinians as if they are not really humans, or their life does not matter at all for them, and that because Israel always can get away with all these crimes without anyone internationally to condemn these kind of brutal attacks on the Palestinian prisoners, and because Israel is feeling always that they are above the law and they can get away with whatever crime they can commit against the Palestinians.
Professor Naim, well, the question is, how can the status quo change then?
Well, what we need in reality, because the Israelis, they don't care, and their laws allow them to do these kind of atrocities against the Palestinians. What we need by the international community, not only a condemnation and statements of condemnation, but rather to start to take actions against the violation of the international law and the human rights laws. In this respect, we believe that international community should start putting pressure on Israel by economic means or by cutting or by really punishing the Israelis till they correct their records or till they stop these kind of atrocities against the Palestinians. Without the international community taking such a step, it will be continued, because the Israelis having the American administration always backing them up, so they don't care at all about what's going on regarding the international community. So we need the international community once and once again to start taking actions against Israel and to stop these methods of condemnation and statements regarding expressing their concern and all this stuff that they used to do, but rather to take action, to take steps towards really punishing Israel in regarding the human rights record that they have.
All right, thanks a lot, Professor Saad Naim, joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, French President Emmanuel Macron has called for an unscheduled national security meeting to discuss the use of the Israeli-made Pegasus spyware in his country. A French government spokesman said Macron has taken the issue very seriously and is dedicating the meeting to the question of cybersecurity. The meeting comes amid recent reports showing the usage of Pegasus software for spying on international figures, including activists, journalists, and politicians. Macron himself has been enlisted as a potential target of the spyware created by an Israeli firm, NSO. It has been strongly criticized for the software's misuse for espionage activities in many countries, including the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain. Syrian air defenses have intercepted several Israeli missiles over the western province of Homs. A military source says the attack has only caused material damage. Our Damascus correspondent joined us early with more on the incident. Let's take a listen.
Syrian state media confirmed that there has been an Israeli aggression on Syria, particularly on the city of, on the governorate of Homs. The Syrian state TV also confirmed that the attack exactly targeted the area of Al-Qsir. Al-Qsir is a border town with Lebanon. It's just 8 kilometers away from northern Lebanon over there. No further details were given by any official source yet. However, usually a statement comes out from an official military source giving some detail. What we know for sure is that air defenses were activated directly with the aim of intercepting the enemy missiles. Now, this Israeli attack comes only 24 hours after a similar one in which Israel attacked yesterday the area of Al-Sfera, south of Aleppo, targeting Syrian army positions over there.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has announced the opening of a new oil export terminal in the Gulf of Oman that will allow the shipments to avoid the strategic Strait of Hormuz. Speaking during a cabinet meeting, Rouhani said the 1,000-kilometer pipeline is now operational at the port city of Jos. Rouhani noted that the pipeline was built in a matter of 2 years. He said the project is the Islamic Republic's most strategic one that has been accomplished during the current administration. The president added Iran's oil has been exported through the Gulf of Oman, and that's what makes this project very significant. Rouhani said the inauguration of this project is a firm response to applauders, particularly the United States. South Korea says the U.S. is awaiting Pyongyang's response to its offer for resuming denuclearization talks. The remark came from the office of South Korean President Moon Jae-in. That after a meeting between Moon and visiting U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman in Seoul, Sherman expressed hope that North Korea will soon respond to Washington's offer. She also said that she will discuss the issue with China during her visit there at the weekend as part of the East Asian tour. North Korea has so far given the cold shoulder to proposals from the administration of President Joe Biden for talks. It says U.S. Talk of diplomacy is all words and no action and aimed at covering up its hostile acts. China has rejected a World Health Organization plan to audit Chinese labs as part of investigation into COVID origins, calling it arrogant and disrespectful.
This plan takes the hypothesis of China's violation of laboratory procedures causing virus leakage as one of the research priorities. From this point, I can feel the disrespect for common sense and arrogance towards science revealed in this plan.
Zhang added that Beijing will not follow the proposal, saying that it's opposed to politicizing the origin study. He said the Wuhan Institute of Virology has never designed, manufactured, or leaked COVID-19. He said so far the staff and graduate students of the Wuhan Institute have maintained zero infection of COVID-19. On Friday, the WHO proposed a second phase of studies into the pandemic origins, calling on China to be, quote, transparent and open to cooperate. China had earlier called on the UN Health Agency to maintain its scientific and professional positions in tracing the matter. Political commentator Anna Tangen believes the World Health Organization has been under pressure from Washington in its investigation into the origins of COVID-19.
Well, obviously it's under pressure from Washington. I mean, that has not been hidden. There have been complaints about the leadership and the organization. There's been nitpicking at its budget, at its role, etc. It's a shame. The WHO was the only thing that was a clear bellwether in terms of what was necessary to be done, and now they're attacking that because they basically failed the test of dealing with it in their own countries. China feels that it was burnt when it cooperated with the WHO COVID investigation, and they feel that this is just, by many entities out there, a witch hunt that is more interested in painting China in a bad light than it is at getting at the truth. So rather than deal with the politics, China's asking that only scientific bodies recognize nonpartisan groups are involved in any kind of future investigations, and that these investigations not only target China, but look elsewhere.
Australian officials have warned that coronavirus cases could rise further as the country is struggling to contain a rapidly spreading Delta variant of the disease. The country's most populous state, New South Wales, reported 124 new infections, the highest in 16 months. Victoria State also logged 26 cases, a higher figure than a day before. The spike comes despite a weeks-long lockdown on over 13 million Australians, which has angered citizens. From the start of the pandemic, 915 Australians have succumbed to COVID-19. The overall caseload there is now hovering around 32,000. Authorities have been criticized for the slow vaccination process, with just 11% of the population being fully vaccinated so far. In Greece, police have fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse crowds protesting against mandatory coronavirus vaccinations. About 1,500 people took part in the march on the parliament in Athens against the government's COVID-19 inoculation drive. A similar rally was held last Wednesday and drew more than 5,000 people. The demonstrations were held despite Greece witnessing a surge in infections in recent weeks. Meanwhile, hundreds of people have gathered in France's capital to protest against the implementation of health pass and compulsory vaccinations. Some protesters were carrying banners reading, quote, freedom to choose and hands off my natural immunity. The protests come as the French government seeks to rein in a fourth wave of COVID-19 infections in the country. New environment ministers say recent floods in Western Europe and extreme weather events around the globe must act as a wake-up call. Activists say the 27 country bloc's climate change goals are not ambitious enough. Jerome Hughes reports.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe, the floods you've mentioned, droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which about has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Health tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the third episode of our series Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce to you Farabi Hospital in Tehran, a leading hospital in the field of eye surgery and ophthalmology in Iran. Please stay with us. Ophthalmology has been studied and developed in Iran for well over 1,000 years. Traces of this branch of medicine can be found in the writings of some well-known Iranian scientists. For example, the world-renowned Iranian physician Mohammad ibn Zakaria Razi, who lived from 854 to 925 AD, mentions various forms of eye disease in the second chapter of his famous book, Al-Hawi. The book is a medical encyclopedia which served as a reference text for centuries after it was written. Mohammad ibn Zakaria Razi was the first physician doctor to systematically study and write about eye disease. He was also the first physician to study the reaction of the human eye and the pupil of the eye to light. He was also the first to recognize that eye penis is the trachoma disease. It's worth mentioning that Razi's authoritative medical encyclopedia, Al-Hawi, had a major influence on development of medicine and medical practice in Europe for centuries. The book became part of the medical curriculum taught at European universities for centuries. As ophthalmology, in parallel to other sciences, had advanced and developed in recent decades, with doctors and specialists making remarkable advances, Iran has also contributed significantly to this important area of medicine. The Islamic Republic of Iran has successfully trained highly qualified and experienced ophthalmologists and eye specialists who are leading researchers and physicians in this field. Benefiting from experienced doctors and modern medical facilities as well as modern infrastructure, Iran has turned into a pioneering state in the field of ophthalmology, and the role played by Farabi Hospital is certainly significant. The hospital is considered one of the leading centers of ophthalmology in Iran and the West Asia region. Farabi Hospital, established in 1921, is one of the oldest hospitals in Iran. Almost two decades after its establishment, Iran's first chair of ophthalmology was founded at this hospital in a building with an area of 13,000 square meters in 1946, where three-year specialist ophthalmology courses were held. Those students who successfully completed the training courses at the university were able to take part in these specialist courses and become a qualified ophthalmologist after passing the relevant exams and writing a thesis. One of the iconic figures in ophthalmology in Iran is the late Professor Mohammad Qoli Shams, who played a key role in eradicating trachoma in this country. In 1957, the first eye surgery operating room was opened in Farabi Hospital and was named in honor of Professor Shams, who also performed the first corneal graft operation in 1934 in Farabi Hospital. Professor Mohammad Qoli Shams is known as the father of ophthalmology in Iran. Farabi's ophthalmology department at first included various sections such as ear, nose, throat, ENT, a lab and pharmacy with 120 inpatient beds, which later expanded to 220 beds. After the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the Farabi Hospital was renovated and expanded considerably, offering a lot more specialist services to patients. The expansion of the hospital included the construction of a new building with an area of 23,000 square meters, which was added to the old structure in 1987. The Eye Hospital is now one of the biggest and most well-equipped medical centers of its kind in the West Asia region, offering myriad specialist services for treatment of eye disease to patients who previously used to go abroad to seek treatment. Thank you. Farabi is a state-run hospital that offers a wide range of medical services at a very reasonable cost. Therefore, the hospital has been able to successfully attract many patients from abroad, especially from countries neighboring Iran as well as from Europe. The cost of treatment at Farabi Hospital compares favorably and is significantly lower than the cost of treatment in European hospitals and hospitals within the Arab world. It's worth mentioning that Farabi Hospital is currently equipped with the most modern and state-of-the-art medical facilities, employing the world's most advanced medical equipment, turning the hospital into one of the best medical centers of its kind in the region. The Farabi Hospital currently has 227 active beds, 57 scientific boards, 80 assistants, and 16 special fellowships. LASIK, commonly referred to as laser eye surgery or laser vision correction, is a type of refractive surgery for the correction of myopia, hyperopia, and astigmatism. Farabi Hospital has a laser eye surgery section, which is equipped with advanced facilities, two operating rooms, and two refractive surgery clinics, keratoconus and cornea keratoplasty, as well as imaging and refraction rooms. Also, one of the most important sections of this hospital is the stem cell processing unit that is in charge of cell therapy, extracting and cloning cells and stem cells. Since its establishment, the Farabi Hospital has always drawn the attention of doctors and ophthalmologists from Iran's neighboring countries, especially Arab countries bordering Iran. Patients from these countries not only receive expert consultation from the hospital's doctors, but also introduce and send the patient to the hospital for receiving diagnostic services to this center, resulting in establishing International Patient Department, IPD, in a hospital for offering suitable services to foreign patients. The IPD department at Farabi Hospital was founded in 2017 with the aim of admitting and facilitating foreign patients' stay in Iran. This IPD department employs the best specialist doctors in the field of ophthalmology. There is also a VIP section for those patients who ask for it. The IPD department of Farabi Hospital is also equipped with 7 rooms for monitoring patients, offering a variety of services for the comfort of patients, such as Wi-Fi, TV, and private WC and bath for each room. The medical staff and nurses are fluent in Arabic and English. Dear listeners, for further information, you can go to the official website of Farabi Hospital, that is http://farabi.tums.ac.ir, or contact the international department of the hospital, that is farabi.vip@tums.ac.ir. Dear listeners, this has been the 3rd episode of our series Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless. The Spotlight.
An Israeli spyware has been used to spy on human rights activists and journalists worldwide. It has also targeted the phones of French, Iraqi, and Moroccan leaders, among others. The obvious question is whether this was done with the knowledge of Israeli authorities or not. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how this spying software was used by dictatorial regimes like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, in which, in the case of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince used it to spy on slain dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
How safe are our mobile phones? This is a question many activists and journalists have been pondering for some time now. And according to an investigation by 17 media organizations, it appears that many of their worst fears have been confirmed. Their investigation found that human rights activists, journalists, and lawyers across the world were targeted by authoritarian states using hacking software sold by Israeli surveillance company NSO Group. The spyware, referred to as Pegasus, acts as malware, infecting mobile phones, enabling operators to extract crucial information and secretly activate microphones. Press TV spoke to global security expert Alex Okoman about what all this means.
So they're not just tracking criminals, but they're also tracking any professionals who are doing the job professionally, but the fear of being exposed by these journalists, and you become an enemy.
Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Hungary, India, Azerbaijan, Mexico, and Rwanda are the states that have been accused of purchasing the controversial software, with allegations that the hacking device was used on the phone of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi before he was hacked to pieces inside a Saudi consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Khashoggi's close friends were also believed to have their phones surveilled soon after his murder.
And in Khashoggi's case, this is clear. What he was doing is to expose the dirty things happening in Saudi Arabia, but obviously the kingdom and also the regime, the establishment, is not happy. And when an establishment is not happy, obviously they have all the resources to keep you quiet or to get rid of you.
If these allegations are proven to be true, it will indicate surveillance on a global level from Budapest to Riyadh that is not only a major world crime, but also an attack on the principle of holding authoritarian states to account. Ahmed Kibala, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Richard Becker, who joins us, who's a member of ACT Now to Stop War and End Racism. We also have Elijah Magnier, who's a veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia and also North Africa. All right, let me first come to you, Elijah Magnier. Let's review what this software is and its purpose. It's an Israeli company, NSO. It's made a software that's called Pegasus. And Pegasus is a malware, according to the description given, that infects iOS and Android devices, which enables the operators of that to extract messages, to extract photos, emails, to record calls, and secretly, and that's the key word there, activate the microphones and also activate the cameras. So based on that, isn't it safe to conclude that the purpose of this software is spying or surveilling?
Thank you for having me. I spoke to different European experts in security, and I've been told that this malware exists since many years. And what is not said in the report distributed or released recently is every single European country has it. And every single European country needs to seek a permission from Israel to give it to another state, even if it is a friendly state. Without the permission of Israel, this can't happen. So every single European country is not only spying on its citizen, but is spying on the same European and non-European leaders. And the problem of this spying program is it turns the phone on, even if you switch your phone off, and it turns the camera, it's a GPS, it indicates the location, it downloads the email, all the messages, all the voice messages, written messages, even when you talk, this can be exactly copied by this software and send to the surveillance agency. And there is more than one surveillance agency in every country who can tap into use this software and use it against their citizens. Therefore, more than one agency has this spying device that is used not only against journalists, but against everyone who is considered interesting for the security services. And that's a clear violation of human rights, clear violation of the privacy, and it is just destroy the word of democracy and freedom of expression here. And what is more serious about it is every single European country knows about it and is aware of its presence and is also knowledgeable that other countries are using it. And when these are using it against heads of state, we learned that even Macron's phone, the French president, was under surveillance. And we also know that heads of state and prime ministers in the Middle East, each one was under the scrutiny of a secret service in one country or another. So basically, everything is exposed. And the last bit here is there is no phone that is not breakable, including what iPhone was saying, that the latest phone is really very solid and protected, and this turned out to be a lie.
Uh-huh. Well, Richard Beckert, so we can then conclude that this spyware was used to target journalists. Aside from what Elijah Magnier has said, you have a consortium of 17 media outlets, activists, researchers who have found this really company software to target, as our guest there, Elijah Magnier, said, the smartphones of these activists and journalists and executives, and of course some of those leaders includes 10 prime ministers. So can we establish that at this point to say that it's no longer an allegation, this is indeed true?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that it's true. I mean, there is an agreement among multiple prominent media in the world and organizations that have investigated this. And so the denials that come from the NSO in the state of Israel that their program has been used to identify, to follow, to target, to surveil people rings very hollow. This is something that the state of Israel has obviously used program or very similar programs. And one way you can know that is that when Israel carries out its bombing of Gaza, which is defenseless against that bombing, but when they do, very often, not all the time, but sometimes, they call up the people who are in a building that's going to be struck and tell them, you have 10 minutes to get out, we're going to bomb. It appears that Israel has created through either this surveillance program or very, very similar ones, the capacity to identify virtually where everyone is in Palestinian areas of the state or in the West Bank and Gaza, East Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there's so much behind this that I'd like to break open. And Elijah Magnier, one of the things that I'd like to find out from you, if I can, you know, the company itself says that it vets the buyers of this, despite the fact that we have seen how this has been sold to regimes that have poor human track records. Elijah Magnier, are you with us? Okay, let me go to you, Richard Becker. So when it says that it does that, we know that the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have purchased this. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because the million-dollar question here, Richard Becker, is the fact if Israel is actually involved here. I mean, based on what has been disclosed, Israel does play a role in terms of the clients that this company can sell its software to. And multiple sources have actually corroborated that the fact that they pushed for Saudi Arabia to be added to the list of the customers. And it says that the group actually did not want to pursue Saudi Arabia any longer as a client, or the UAE. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure where that's coming from, but it's, you know, we can see that the UAE, which Israel has just very triumphantly opened relations with, despite it, you know, it's really something. I just have to say parenthetically, United Arab Emirates is a country of about 11 million people, and about 10 million of them are forbidden ever to become citizens of that country. and it's a police state, and the idea that they're not using this kind of equipment to track opponents is belied by the fact that we have that the ruler of Dubai and the prime minister of United Arab Emirates just sent commandos, you know, very recently to capture his daughter, who didn't want to live under that kind of a system and escape, and they found her using this technology, either her own phone or the phone of some of her aides, in international waters, and brought her back, and she, you know, so she's suffering from that. I mean, a lot of people are suffering probably much worse fates than she has so far. But I think that particular case shows that, you know, that it makes it clear that this equipment, this program has been supplied to the UAE. And also, it seems quite clear that it's been supplied to the another extremely repressive government where there's no freedom for people, and that's the government of Saudi Arabia.
Well, Elijah Magnier, let me ask you this, because we have to establish this. And it's very confusing somewhat that you have this software company that's based out of Israel, and this is where the line is a little bit blurred. And I'd like to find out from you, based on that French organization that studied this case and investigated it and revealed some of the facts that we have in this conversation right now, that Israel and its officials were actually choosing the clients for the software. It was saying, you have to sell it to Saudi Arabia, you have to sell it to the UAE. And it says that the software company says, it wasn't even up to us. We don't want to sell it to authoritarian regimes. But Israeli officials were making us do that. So does that show intent from Israel to have these regimes like UAE and Saudi Arabia use the device to spy on journalists, politicians, etc.? Is Israel guilty?
This is a very good question. There are many points here. The first point is this company has been established in 2010. The revelation that there is a spyware developed by Israel and offered to European and non-European countries came out in 2016. This is indicate that Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, have already established good relationship with Israel to be given a spyware that is highly sophisticated. However, the other side of this spyware is whatever the countries are spying on, it is again related to the same company who can collect the same data. So basically, to explain better, Israel is providing this spyware, but it is in a position to collect the data that each country with the authorization to use the spyware, and this country is collecting the information. This information is also shared with Israel. Therefore, Israel is collecting a bank of information that is huge, coming from different countries who are supposed to be friendly countries, because they need an authorization from Israel to release it. This is when I talked to security officers. They told me that we are not entitled to give it to any other country without the permission of Israel. So there is no secret here. The Israelis are willingly giving this spyware to countries they consider friendly, with whom they also share data. So these countries like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, they are sharing spyware data, spy information, and collecting data and giving it also to Israel.
So, Richard Becker, I'm guessing that there's something illegal about this. I would think that that's a conclusion that can be made here. And therefore, based on that, what can be done? I mean, I'm not sure what word to use when I ask the question, what can be done, when we're looking at countries like the U.S., France, and U.K. selling arms to these same regimes that are killing people in Yemen, for example, and yet we have here a case where it's still continuing to this day.
Well, it's really something. I mean, it's outrageous what's happening. There has to be an outcry from people in many countries against this, and a demand that it end, but it probably will not end. It's probably going to continue. I mean, just today, I think Israel is now functioning kind of like a 21st century Sparta. There's reports today that all the top officer or top officers from all of the military services in the U.S. are in Utah, and they've gathered there in Utah to see a demonstration of a new loitering drone, loitering weapon that Israel has developed, and apparently was used in the by the Azerbaijani forces in the war against Armenia. And this weapon also has a what they call a very high degree of autonomy, meaning that it may kill on its own. It has the capacity to do that without getting orders. But this is what's happening. This is what you know, contributions to the world that we're getting, not only from Israel, but from other weapons manufacturers and surveillance manufacturers, but particularly coming from Israel are some of the most advanced forms of surveillance and weaponry to the detriment of people in the world. And people should know this. They should know that this is what's happening. And also, one other connection, I believe that this firm, the NSO firm, is owned by an equity fund based in New York. So there's another connection, a big connection. That's who the company real owners are.
Yeah, indeed, that's actually a great topic for another edition of the Spotlight here. Okay, so so we've covered that, Elijah, to some length. But then you have the other issue that's involved here, and it involves not to bring up Saudi Arabia and the UAE so much, but that, again, I'm basing this on the report by Citizen Lab, where it said that they have been using this software extensively, and based on the report that I'm reading over here, it said that the usage was actually significantly to have increased between the years 2016 and August of 2018, and the increase was used to spy on their own citizens. Why do you think that the UAE and Saudi Arabia would need to use this software that's powerful in so many ways on their own citizens?
That's a very good question, because the regimes are fragile, and because there is no democracy in the country, and because anyone that belongs to the opposition or voices an opposition voice is immediately taken in prison and condemned harshly. So these countries need to spy on their citizens to make sure that they can oppress any opposition group or individual who they think it represents a danger to the national security of the country. Therefore, we again talking about spying illegally, and there is no freedom of expression in these countries. Inevitably, they need to know what's happening and who's against or with the regime. And also they need to know who is in contact with whom abroad. And this is again a share of information, of intelligence information between states who very much know that this state is spying on citizens, and the information is shared with democratic states in Western countries, knowingly that this information has been obtained illegally. Now, the best way to avoid it, and that was amusing when you ask it, is simply not to carry a smartphone.
I'll never forget the headline that I read, Richard Becker. This is going back quite some time, in which the CIA said, based on the headline, "We're going to spy on you through your refrigerator," in which it said household appliances like dishwashers or ovens, stereo and TVs, can be used to spy. Is spying then just the norm? Is spying on whether it's UAE, Saudi Arabia, or the U.S. on citizens something that needs to be done in order for there to be a watch on the citizens of these countries?
Well, you know, I don't think it's just those countries either. I think that if we really look at the United States, right, the most powerful country in the world, there's crisis after crisis after crisis, and often multiple crises taking place at the same time. That's the truth of the matter. And it's really the system that exists in the world today and the inequality that exists in the world today is outrageous. It's beyond description. You have four individuals in the United States who have as much wealth as the bottom 165 million people. That's not a sustainable situation. So I think that we're going to see, I think the reality is that governments from Saudi Arabia to the United Arab Emirates to Israel to the United States to France, They're all going to rely increasingly on surveillance and repression. These systems have to be changed. It cannot go on like this. These are, you know, the systems that are really destroying the world and destroying the rights of people all over the world. But I think they're going to rely on this, and we have to find the ways to organize, and that's taking place, to bring about a new system.
Final question goes to you, Elijah Magnier. You know, when we take a look at the result of what has happened in some sense out of this surveillance, if you want to call it that, we have to bring up the case of Jamal Khashoggi, in which Saudi Arabia used this software and obviously gathered data and information on him, of which we know obviously what the end result of that was. So that has happened. We still have Saudi Arabia and this company is to cooperate with each other, or for Saudi Arabia to continue using its software. What is it going to take so this doesn't happen? I mean, Saudi Arabia is still on a path of trying to silence dissent of its critics.
There is no way to stop it, unfortunately, because every country is using it under the title combating terrorism. And to combat terrorism, they say we need to tap phones and listen to people if they represent a danger against us. Well, that can be stopped only if every single decision is taken by a justice system, and the justice system is independent. Unfortunately, we don't have that system. Therefore, surveillance will continue, and arresting people because of what they said, depending on the person listening or the software that is collecting the information and consider this as a potential target, this is going to continue in every single country with this spyware or with other developed spyware.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Elijah Magnier, veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia and North Africa. Thank you for your contribution. Richard Becker, thank you. Member of Act Now to Stop War and End Racism from the Answer Coalition. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tafwe, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We've spoken about how our relationship should be with fellow Muslims, whether they are righteous Muslims, whether they are non-practicing Muslims, whether they are hypocrites. We've also spoken about how to deal with non-Muslims and the different categories of non-Muslims. Now, the stage has come now where we speak about how to deal with enemies, or how to deal with people who are not in favor of us, not liking us. And this is something, of course, very, very natural. Throughout the process of your life, you're always going to come across with certain people who might be different with you in their ideology, in their opinion, in their conduct, in their behavior. There might be a dispute, there might be certain issues that escalate to such a level where they become hostile towards you. Now, there are different kinds of that level of hostility that a person has towards somebody else, but it's never going to be something good or something positive. And as Muslims, we need to try as much as we can to stay away from any kind of enmity or hatred or creating of any level of discord or sedition or problems with other people. There's a very interesting verse in the Quran, in Surah Al-Mumtahina, ayah number 4, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks about those who have openly and aggressively expressed their enmity towards not only Islam, but the Muslims. Now, setting, of course, what we need to do is we set Islam as an example of how we deal with these kind of people. And it should never be the case where we react emotionally. It should never be the case where we, if I could say, take things into our own hand and escalate the problem, allow things to get worse and worse. Because the central focus of what it is that Islam teaches us is we need to have that passive approach towards those who might want to be aggressive towards us. Does this